Let's go in. We're at the cathedral now, so let's go inside the cathedral because I think we're going to meet another musician in here.
My father always told me, son, be smart. Buy yourself an African to pull that heavy cart. My father always said, son, use your brain. Buy yourself an African to cut your sugar cane. My father was a Bristol man in trade. In sugar and molasses, there were fortunes to be made. To gain a place in high society, a man must grow his interest in this golden industry. We headed for the coast of Senegal, with copper cloth and gunpowder, pretty beads and wool. Then southward to the port of Calabar, where the smell of death hangs heavy, and tobacco smoke and tar. And I found myself in Africa. We bartered with the Barbary corsair, his dagger on his waist and on his face the blackest hair. The captain said the devil's in that man, but God was on our side and we'd be guided by his hand. And I bought myself an African.
I'm the Reverend Dr. Mandy Ford, and I'm the Dean of Bristol.
Mandy, you brought us to a plaque here which says, in memory of John Isaac. Who was John Isaac?
John Isaac was an enslaved African who worked on plantations owned by the Daniel family. And if you look above us, you can see an enormous window which was put in the Victorian period by the Daniel descendants to honour their parents. Now, the problem with that is that this was a family that made enormous amounts of money, both out of the labour of enslaved Africans, and then after the abolition bill, payment for the British government for the loss of their enslaved labour. And a wonderful woman called Gloria Daniel, the clue's in the surname, traced her own ancestry back to John Isaac and came and talked to us about having a memorial in the cathedral which would flip the story and would honour those who were enslaved. And so we've worked with Gloria and her family to install this monument to John Isaac and the 4,424 other enslaved Africans for whom the Daniel family received compensation.
And has this been a difficult issue for you? Because are there other slave-owning families who are memorialised in the cathedral and its precincts?
Oh, yes. We started out with an issue around a window which memorialises Edward Colston, and we realised we would have to do some serious research to understand the scale of the problem. So we brought on board a research partner who looked at all of those who were memorialised or buried in the cathedral between about 1650 and 1900. Of those, around 1,000 names, we can show first-generation contact with plantations and enslaved Africans in 200 cases. So 20% of the people who, in some way, were part of this community had benefited from transatlantic chattel enslavement. And I think what that tells us is wasn't just a few bad apples. It was absolutely every middle-class person in Bristol. I often say if you kept your money in the bank, if you drank tea, if your clothes were made of cotton, then you were deeply implicated in what was a horrific and sinful activity.
Of course, it's highly controversial, and some people say, why on earth are you disturbing the story that we've always been told of our history? Why are you bringing to the fore all this anguish right now? What do you say to those people who get upset?
Very simple. In the city of Bristol, if you come from an African or an African Caribbean background, you are more likely to be in poverty, have poor educational attainment, have poor health, experience housing difficulty. There is a red line between the experience of enslavement and racial discrimination, racial deprivation in this city. It's not just something that existed in the past, it's part of our living experience and a challenge to us all in Bristol today.
One of the things that Reg has been talking about is the fact that a lot of the slave owners were very religious people, and they were people who thought of themselves as devout Christians. How do you cope with that dichotomy?
Well, being a Christian doesn't stop you being sinful or being wrong. I think that's the first thing that I'd want to say. And secondly, we're all, open to being beguiled by falsehood, aren't we? And in that period, there were theological arguments made in favour of slavery, in favour of racial discrimination. And I think it took real courage, actually, to stand up against the general flow of justification for what we now see as being a horrific practice.
If Satan owns the cursed barbarian, and God's with us, then who stands with the wretched African? Abandoned by all saints and gods he seemed, and cast into some nightmare, some forsaken spirit dreamed. And I bought myself an African queen. And so the day went on, and by the end, I'd bought 200 women folk, and girls and boys and men. The captain said, these bodies that you see, think on them as chattels, like some cheap commodity. And I bought another African three. And so the day went on, and by the end, I'd bought 200 women folk, and girls and boys and men. The captain said, these bodies that you see, think on them as chattels, like some cheap commodity. And I bought another African three. I bought another African three.
Now, you may have noticed during that song that we were joined by a kora player, Madhu Njai. Madhu, fantastic to have you here. And you've got the kora sitting in your lap. Just tell us a bit about the instrument.
Kora is a West African harp made of calabash. Some people call it pumpkin. Uh-huh. At the front of the kora also is a cow skin. The strings are simply a fishing nylon strings. We hold the kora with the three fingers, and then to play the kora, you just use your two thumb, and then just two fingers.
Just give us an example.
Yeah.
Say that you started smiling as soon as you started playing, and I started smiling too. There's something about the kora that makes you happy, isn't there?
Yes, absolutely. This instrument is, some people call it, you know, it's connected with the spirit. So when you play, just it make you happy. And the people who play it, we call them griot. And a griot in West Africa, they're a storyteller, historian, entertainer, and at the same time, they bring peace between a people, between the village, between neighbors. So that's why this instrument is very peaceful. When you play this, it make you, give you the joy.
Now, you come from quite a family of griots, don't you?
Yeah.
Presumably it's passed on from father to son. Father to son, usually male, is it?
Yes, in the old day, yes, it used to be father to son, father to son. Now, in the 21st century, kora is very open now. So you see some women now, they joining and play kora.
Did you learn it then from your father?
I learned it from my dad, and I learned it from my grandfather.
How many brothers do you have?
I have four brothers. One called Siku Keita, and there's another one, a second one called Sura Suso, and the last one is called Suntu Suso, who played with Raj.
I met him, yes, because he's played in this project as well. So you're all kora players?
We're all kora players.
And you all live in the UK?
We all live in the UK, yes.
Right.
Yes, and we all play and we compose as well, and also we play and sing together.
Whole family gets together?
The whole family, yes.
Is there any suggestion that you might not be a kora player? Like you might have said, oh, I'd like to be a footballer or an accountant or an astronaut or something.
Yes. For me, when I was younger, I wanted to be a bass player.
And what did your grandfather say about
that? He said, no.
Not allowed.
Yeah, he said, I'm not allowed. And then I just decided to be a djembe player.
Which is percussion.
Percussion, yes. Yeah. It was, at the beginning, it was very tough for me.
Well, because the family didn't like it?
Yeah, because my grandfather didn't agree with me to play the djembe. But I tried many times, I tried to persuade him, but he never agree with me. And one day he saw me playing the djembe, and finally he decided to let me just play the djembe. But he said to me, I don't mind you to play the djembe, but I want you to keep your heritage, keep playing the kora.
Thank you.